Hello, welcome everybody to this week's edition of Truth to Power here on your community radio station. We are Forward Radio WFMPLP, broadcasting from the top of the historic Hayburn Building here in downtown Louisville at 106.5 FM and live streaming to the world at forwardradio.org. Excited that we have a guest from around the world outside of Louisville today here on Truth to Power, extending our reach of community radio well beyond the borders of Louisville. My name is Justin Mogg. I'm a programmer here at the station. I do a show called Sustainability Now, and co-hosting again with me this week is another programmer from The Climate Report and Let's Talk, heard every day on this station at 7 p.m. It's Hart Hagen. Welcome, Hart.
Hi, Justin. Good to be here.
Yeah, great to be here again with you. And we also have a return guest here on Truth to Power. We have Jake Bush from Democratic Socialists of America Louisville chapter right here in the virtual studio with us again. Welcome, Jake.
Hey, Justin. I'm happy to be here. Really excited about today's topic.
Yes, I haven't even mentioned it, but I want to get all the guests mentioned, and then we'll talk about the topic in a minute. And we have from out of town, Kelly McGuffey joining us from Springfield, Tennessee. She's a mother and an activist who was born across the river from us in Indiana and also raised, spent some time in Huntsville, Alabama, and now settled in Springfield. It is so good to have you on the show, Kelly. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, guys.
So we are here for the new Truth to Power book club. we're going to dive into the 1993 classic by Cornel West called Race Matters. Hart, you can reflect on why you chose this as our book for the week or the month. You tell our listeners how we're structuring this, but I'm just going to say that what a great title for us to start talking about in these revolutionary times. Where a whole lot of white folks are suddenly waking up to the injustices that have been in this country for so long, right? And people of all colors are out on the streets saying that race matters and that Black Lives Matter. And so now's a good time.
And then some people are in complete denial about the fact that race matters.
Not everybody is one, and we are here. Right. We are here to expand that conversation today. But yeah, Hart, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about how you came across this title and why you chose it, and how we're going to do this book club with listeners.
Right. Well, let me read from the epilogue to the book. Spoiler alert: I'm reading from the end. But I think that'll be okay. But yeah, I love Cornel West. He's very intellectual. He's also very warm. And he actually loves his enemies. You know, the Bible says, love your enemies. And how many people can actually actualize that? And he's one person that I know who does. And so this is from the epilogue of the book that I think sets the stage. It says, we are living in one of the most frightening moments in the history of this country. Democracies are quite rare and usually short-lived in the human adventure. The precious notion of ordinary people living lives of decency and dignity, owing to their participation in the basic decision-making in those fundamental institutions that affect their life chances, is difficult to sustain over space and time. And every historic effort to forge a democratic project has been undermined by two fundamental realities, poverty and paranoia. The persistence of poverty generates levels of despair that deepen social conflict. The escalation of paranoia produces levels of distrust that reinforce cultural division. Race is the most explosive issue in American life precisely because it forces us to confront the tragic facts of poverty and paranoia, despair and distrust. In short, a candid examination of race matters takes us to the core of the crisis of American democracy and the degree to which race matters in the plight and predicament of fellow citizens is a crucial measure of whether we can keep alive the best of this democratic experiment we call America.
Jeez.
That's the epilogue, huh?
Profound, but he, like I said, he's not lying. He's, like I said, it's got a lot of glitter on it, guys. I'm not gonna lie to you, but he's not lying. You know, as impoverished people, as some of us go through our lives, you know, and this is not just at this point just a strictly race matters, but more of a class matters. Race is also, of course, heavily intermingled, but as class warfare is waged, you know, there is more of an us and them attitude between the suburbs and the inner cities. And the inner cities, as they become more diverse, you know, it's becoming a more recognized problem. Whereas, you know, it was the inner city was just for a few groups of immigrants or people of color or you know, a certain religious persuasion, you know, or sexual persuasion. But now everybody's kind of smashed together. You don't kind of have to stay in that box, but you do also have to stay within the confines of poverty. And, you know, through microaggressions on a daily basis, you do become very paranoid. You don't want to be that person that's thinking, well, why are you, did you stare too long? Did you not stare long enough? It wears on you on a daily basis, just never really knowing.
Kelly, when we talked on the phone, you were telling me about your experiences growing up in the schools in Indiana and some race-based hate that you faced. Can you describe some of that?
Oh, it was vicious. I will hold my fingers up to the camera, and there are two slice scars right across there that I look at daily. Those come from a dog that a girl who was my friend set loose on me because she wanted to see if Black people were fast.
Wow.
Those were her words as I stood there bleeding, and she explained it to her grandmother why she had sticked the dog on me. She said she wanted to see if Black people were fast. Growing up, my parents were an interracial couple. I was born exactly 9 years after the Loving decision. I live with the fact that my life to President Nixon, when he considered legalizing abortion in this country, it was because of rape and interracial relationships that he allowed for abortion to be even legal, because he considered myself problem to the nation, you know. So that's got to be, those girls have got to have a way to get that fixed, you know. They shouldn't have to live with that stigma all their lives, you know. So that's my American experience. Like I said, 9 years before I was nine, not even a decade before I was born, I couldn't have inherited the property I lived on. My daddy couldn't give me something. I would have to walk away as a stranger, an orphan. When my father passed away, it was legal for them to take everything from me. That's the legacy that we're kind of handed. It was difficult, you know. I was the only Black child in an all-white elementary, high school, and middle school all in one. It was a very rural community, and it was the 80s, and it was unpleasant. It was very bad. It was, you know, and I would go home to my mother and father who had this racial utopia in their mind. And they're like, I'm like, look, they're beating the hell out of me. They're trying to kill me out here. I'm getting spit on. You know, they're trying to burn me with cigarettes. And they're like, well, you know, as long as we love you, everybody's going to love you. That is a lie. That was a lie that two lovers tell each other in the bed. In the real world where I had to go when the love was gone, you know, it was like stormy seas, stormy, stormy seas. And I then had to leave that situation because I had defended myself. I pulled a young man off of the merry-go-round, and I hurt him. I hurt him. And at that point in time, they were ready to expel me. After I had gone to them for 4 years, I was at this school. I went to them every day and I told them what they did. And I got the sticks and stones will break my bones. And Dorman Ledbetter would always hurt me. You know, that's just the way it was. And I don't mind name dropping old Dorman either.
Yeah, you're welcome.
No shouts out to Dorman. But, you know, they called me things like an animal. You need to control that beast.
Wow.
You know, it was bad. It was so bad that my Black mother, who taught school in town, which is about 30 miles away, she left her school to come to my school finally after 4 years, and was like, I can remember sitting there and my principal just having tears streaming down her face. Patsy Smith was just crying because she knew it wasn't right. She knew it wasn't right. So in lieu of being expelled, I was moved to a city school in the district where my parents taught. And that was a little bit more diverse, and it allowed for a little bit more exploration. The Black community in Muncie, Indiana, where I happened to go to school, it was small, but it was solid. You know, we had a newspaper, we had our community leaders, we had programming on our local PBS station. My mother did a program on our local PBS station, and we come out of Bob Ross land. That's where I'm from. You know, Bob was right across the hall from my mom's studio. And that's just how I was raised. Mom taught art, dad taught science. There was no way that I wasn't going to be a logical person. It just wasn't going to happen.
If I may, I just wanted to point out, I was born in 94, right? And I say that to say that growing up, you know, a lot of the times, especially because I grew up in such a small, very white, rural area that, you know, I only heard about these kinds of things on TV.
Right.
And I heard it as if this was in some distant prehistoric, you know, right, whatever. And I hear this or like, yeah, or like I hear from like my ex-girlfriend's family. They were a Black family from Louisiana. And they would tell me things, and I'd say, my gosh, when did that happen? And like you, they'd say, oh, like the 80s. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
So, you know, if I may, I read this Democracy Matters and Race Matters piece, which is in the 25th anniversary edition. And I think the important thing when we're talking about Dr. West, the important thing to remember about him is that he is, at his core, a radical Democrat, and not Democrat like the party, but like right, that is the core of his ideology, is his commitment to democracy philosophically. And there's a piece here that I would like to read where it says, the basic aim of a democratic regime is to curb the use of arbitrary powers, especially of government and economic institutions, against its citizens.
Yes.
Based on this uncontroversial criterion, the history of American democracy in regard to Black people from 1776 to 1965 was a colossal failure. And I think that sort of centers the way that I always view his work. And in a way, I mean, that centers a lot of how I just view the world, frankly, because a big part of my own...
You're anti-American.
Right. Well, you gotta, right. You gotta fight that. You know, that idea that that's against America to criticize it. But I am at my core a big believer in democracy, and I believe democracy should be in the workplace. I believe it should be in the government. And I think that if you really take an unbiased...
That's called mob rule. When democracy is everywhere, that's mob rule. Mm.
Right. I love Hart bringing in like the way that other people think, just sprinkling it on top, just reel me back in. Like, hey, you know, this is what other people think, right?
Yeah, I was those other people for most of my life.
Mm. Yeah, no, I get it.
And I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, dude, you're sprinkling the seasoning on it. It's fine.
Right.
But,
that's what I usually think of myself, but others don't.
But you know, if we're really thinking about, you know, the way that this country functions, the way that this country has treated people, and if we understand history as a living thing, and if we understand that things don't just end and then we forget about it. Oh, well, that was back then. No effect
get
on
over
now.
It. Get over it. That was like not right. Even, I wasn't even born yet. I didn't own any slaves.
Right. You know, you hear that. But meanwhile,
you also, your great, great granddad owned the plantation and had 100 people that worked just specifically to build his wealth.
I have a story about that. It's like I can directly trace personal benefits to slave money, and that is as follows. My mother, my mother inherited a substantial amount of money from an uncle by marriage, and this money was used to put me through college. And the uncle by marriage had lived his entire life off of plantation money.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That he had inherited.
Long.
Well, I directly benefited from money that was made on the backs of slaves.
Old money. That's how long that money lasted, Hart. If it was still around to send you to college, that was a hell of a lot of toil for somebody. I don't know, you know, and at the end of the day, we still directly benefit from slavery. Now, you guys might not realize that because you don't live in a county where the biggest plantation is a mile from me. Mm. The Wessington plantation just sits to the west of me. And then the Bell plantation, where the famed Bell Witch comes from, it butts up right against the Wessington. So every day I drive by those fields, miles and miles of fields where they plant tobacco and wheat. And these are all commodities we still benefit from today. And I know full well that land was not just cleared. It was cleared 300-400 years ago when they had the slaves clear it. They didn't just let, because slavery was over, they didn't let the fields grow up with trees. They maintained those fields. It took a lot to get them that way. You know, so we still, if you eat sugar, wear cotton, eat yams, you know, there's just all of these rice. We still benefit directly from slavery, either fiduciary through what we eat, what we consume, the culture. There is still a benefit from slavery. If you have ever used a colloquialism that a person of color might use, that's a benefit of slavery. That did not exist. The damn electric slide. You know, you can't.
I'll never think of my middle school dances the same.
Right? You can't cut it off. There's no cutoff point.
Mm.
There was never a cutoff point. Mm. We are here now, and now we go forward.
So intergenerational wealth transfer is a real thing. Deprivation of wealth on an intergenerational basis is a real thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They, you know, there was a time when you as a black man could own land, but as soon as you died, you couldn't transfer it to your family.
Mm.
You know, like I said, there were so many blockades put in place to black wealth building during Jim Crow. It was the mission of the white South to prevent the acquisition of monies. And I think that part of the problem with Black Wall Street was those people out there, those black people, they were free. They had been free the whole time. They were never slaves. They were always cowboys and farmers. So when they started to build up their community, that's what Americans did. And when somebody came in to threaten that, they fought them because that is the narrative of America. You fight for what you believe in. You fight for your stuff. And it was met with such resistance that it is the only case of bombing of an American city we have in our country by other Americans. You know, and the violence and the brutality that was normalized, you know, the I have a dream speech. It's a dream, but you have to be asleep to dream. This can't be real. Mm. This, you know, this whole whitewashed, I don't want to hear about that part of it. How do you cut off your right arm and leave your left? You know, and just be satisfied. Like, I just never really needed my right arm at all. You know, never needed it. I've always just need this one hand. You know, it's just, how do you surgically separate yourself from the contributions of others to your success?
Mm. Yeah, nobody gains. I mean, no. You know, especially those in the lower, name a number, 90%. The people in the lower 90% don't benefit. Martin Luther King talked about how from time immemorial, the rich white people in the South would play the poor black people and the poor white people off against each other.
Well, yeah.
And they would get they would have this ideology whereby white was better, but that kept the white people, the poor white people on their side. While, you know, disenfranchising, and if you're a laborer who is white and might earn a wage, well, that wage is going to be driven down by slave labor. And then even when the slaves are freed, of course, there are a lot of deprivations that do not allow people to earn their fair wage. And as long as you can hire a black person to work for even less, then that hurt the poor white people. And that kind of dynamic is still going on today.
And I
believe that much of the racism is there's that dynamic in it. There's that motivation in it. The powers that be benefit from racism.
They benefit from your racism, exactly. Slave owners did not ride down black men and women and children in the woods. They didn't do that. They had poor white people to do that.
Yeah.
And who was happy to do it? Poor white people. Surprise. And what made them feel like rich white people? Treating black people bad. Mm-hmm. So it was just, I think it was like they were trying to, just as Cornel West talks about in the beginning of the book, you know, trying to emulate what they believe is actual success, because they see this man, he is wealthy. He has a plantation full of slaves. Some of them look like him. You know, there's a lot of benefits that poor whites saw, just like poor whites still see today. Surprise. I mean, I don't see anything different between this new GOP and what we saw that led up to the Civil War. Like I said, there's always somebody that is out there ready to do a rich man's bidding. Always, still today.
Okay, so I'm not a black person, and I do not speak for black people, and I do not give advice to black people. But I do feel qualified to give advice to white people. And I'm saying your enlightened self-interest requires that you recognize the source of racism. Your enlightened self-interest requires that you find common ground with people of color, because you're in the same boat. Meanwhile, as long as you don't recognize that, you've got the powers that be that cultivate racism. Some of it is in movies, some of it is in TV, some of it is in music. But those subtle or not so subtle forms of racism are bad for the white majority. And it's tragic. And as a climate activist, really, you know, I see that poor people, most of whom are people of color, are the first to suffer the worst consequences from climate change. Not least of all, thousands of people every day die from the effects of climate change, which includes drought. Your crops are not going to do well. You're going to die of kidney failure because of thirst. And there's going to be mass migration. So
the thing,
anyway, I forget where I was even going with that.
The things
solidarity.
We think about.
Oh, solidarity. Yeah, that's, thanks, Jake.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Kelly. Sorry.
The things that we panic about as the majority of Americans, you know, the virus, you know, or, you know, war, things. The top 1% doesn't give a damn. They got bunkers. The president will talk cash money garbage from his podium because he will go hide under a mountain if they drop bombs on us. Because of what he said, we pay, and we can pay out of our hand, out of our lives, out of our psyche, wherever we're paying, but we pay the cost. And until we see each other as equals, nobody's American experience is whole. I really feel like that. How can you move forward and think that your American experience is whole if it's all white? Or it's all black, or it's all LGBTQ. It's not a place where there is a superstar and then the rest of us. This is not Diana Ross and the Supremes. we got to do it together.
We're speaking today on Truth to Power with Kelly McGuffey, a mother and activist in Springfield, Tennessee, raised in Indiana and then Huntsville, Alabama, sharing some of her stories of dealing with racism. That's the topic of our show today, Truth to Power, with me, Justin Mogg, and Hart Hagen. And we're also joined on the line in the virtual studio, again, by Jake Bush from DSA Louisville. Our book of the day is the 1993 classic Race Matters by Cornel West, and that's informed informing our conversation, but I do want to hear some more stories from Kelly. So you were talking about how difficult it was to be one of the only people of color growing up. We've seen a demographic shift in America where that's less and less the case, but I think some of the stories you share may still be true today. And now you are a mother. I don't know how old your children are, but if they're school aged, what is their experience, and what do you fear for about their experience in the world today with racism?
We are in a unique set of circumstances here. I've lived several places, and this is my first. I've never seen such a disconnect and such a scare. I don't know what happened here. Whatever happened, it happened way before I got here. It's an unspoken something amongst the Black community. They don't really organize. They don't really get together. But like I said, we come from two very large plantations in this area. This is called the Black Patch. And what happened is when those plantations went under, the sharecroppers took over. Black and white sharecroppers took over. So we do have a certain level of tentative unity among certain communities. There is a lot of interracial couples here, a lot of biracial children here, but that's a personal choice. You know, that's not a community choice. The community doesn't decide who you marry or who you decide to have a child by, or, you know, those are personal choices within your own home to make. And it is a choice to put it on the scale and reckon it up, because it's not easy. You know for a fact, when you start that interracial relationship, you're going to get some blowback from both sides. You know that, but the quality and character of that person have let you reckon that. You reckon it. You put it on the scale, you weigh it up, and you reckon it up, and you move forward. Because knowing that person means so much more than what you might have to encounter to know that person. And you can't be that person that cares what your community says, because you operate from inward out instead of outward in. And I think that is where we are all going wrong. Like I said, through, you know, you are accountable, to your family to pay the bills, you're accountable to your community to be a good person, your church, or you're accountable. So you can't really say or do what you think you want to say or do. But I think that's wrong. I think that you don't give your genuine self if you don't tell the truth. And this, I can remember in the 90s when everybody needs to be politically correct and let's all be positive and stuff. Well, honey, we were all doing great in the 90s. If you had some dot-com money and you had a little bit of computer knowledge, you didn't even have to go to college. You could just, it was a great time. Buy a big old truck, a big old boat, a big old house. But as you can see, that model did not last very long. You know, it kind of blew up in our faces, and now we're just kind of sitting here in the wreckage. And depending on accountability or respectability politics instead of moral fiber to lead us, you know, that's how we get so many monsters in suits setting our policies for us.
Yeah. And you know, if I could, I would like to
no, you can't.
Pull another patcher. Okay. Well, then I'll leave. No.
Gosh.
No. if I could, that actually brings up something that I was looking at. I'm sort of going back over this passage. And if I could share it here from the foreword that I was pulling from. So Dr. West is saying here, talking about these sort of policies that you're talking about, these sort of people in suits sort of setting all these agendas that end up taking us this, I don't want to say bad path, because it's certainly better than it was, but in some ways, yeah, is it? I don't think I'm really qualified to make that call.
You know, it's not that we're not qualified. I think we're all qualified to make that call. If you have eyes and you've been watching the news, I think we can all safely say something's awry here, guys.
That's true.
You hear that noise in the other room?
That's true. So, you know, he's talking about this, how we've ended up in this situation where there is now an avenue, at least ostensibly, for people to hold positions of power that are not white. That's more possible now than it was.
Absolutely.
But he's saying, and this is a quote, this is so primarily because the advent of the multiracial American regime coincided with escalating levels of wealth inequality. The new inclusion of people of color within the professional slices of American society occurred alongside the expansion of unaccountable corporate power in the economy and government, and the unleashing of arbitrary police power in poor communities of color, especially Black, Brown, and Red. Mm-hmm. The result is Black middle class achievements that constitute Black progress alongside devastated Black working and poor communities that yield unprecedented increases in prison populations and overlooked victims of police abuse.
Yes.
And so what he's getting at is that we can't really have a democratic project, not a real one, unless we understand the way that class and race fit together and how they are both significant, but you can't really separate them, not really. Because if you do, you still end up with an undemocratic society. And so, you know, I think of Stuart Hall's quote. He said something along the lines of, you know, race is the modality through which we experience class.
Yes.
Right. And that you can't, I think too often, and I always love reading Dr. West because I think he really gets this, is that you cannot separate the two. You know, a lot of people, whether you're on the left or you're more in the center, or even if you're on the right, they always try to act as if they're two separate things that are contending with one another, when really, and if we read Dr. West and really take it seriously, I think that he points us in the direction of saying, well, you can't separate the two, at least not honestly, you know?
There's value. There is, unfortunately, we as Americans see things only in monetary values. If we don't have enough money, or we don't have the right address or drive the right car or wear the right suit, we are not respectable. However, there is value in that poor community. When the levees broke in New Orleans, when it was time to rebuild, the question was, is how do we maintain that culture that was washed out? And they were poor people. They were not wealthy people. But at the same time, if you remove that from New Orleans, you might as well just throw it away. Might as well be Seattle. You cannot capitalize off of things that attract people to your city and the culture and the art that these poor people bring. You know, Cornel West talks about the art of the movement and the singers and how much they put their soul into expressing what they had to say about their condition. Well, you have to understand, for a culture that was silenced at every turn, art was our voice. That's why you have such exquisite works from people who you thought were, who your preconceived notion has been given to you as dumb and uneducated and uncouth and brutish, you know, but they were like, in the introduction, that we are the manifestation of all impossibilities. If impossible is anything, it is us. Continuously, we continue to do the things that have been long preached against that we could not do. And I mean, we keep moving the bar a little further, a little further, a little further. And now the bar has moved so far that there is this upwardly mobile class of African Americans. And all power to them. Go to school. If you want to go to school, go to school. But now they are now kind of shackled by their education. Yes, you live in a very large house. you live in a very diverse suburb, but your vote in that suburb does not help me in the inner city. It helps you, the mills and all the money, stay out in the suburbs and helps the poor people in the inner city get poorer. But you know what? You live in a million-dollar house, but you're still scared for your kid to go down the street. You're still scared for your husband to turn the corner in his own neighborhood where he pays a mortgage. That's ridiculous. So what's different? There are poor Black people, there are rich Black people, but the commonality is Black people. I'm sorry. You can't educate that out of yourself, as Cornel West has brilliantly described in the first chapter. You cannot rise above the color of your skin when you deal with a world full of strangers who do not know you. And it doesn't matter how much you elevate within your circle. If the people on the street don't recognize it, what's it for? What's it for? Other than, I get it. I don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Cornell should just throw it all away. But I hurt for that man. I hurt for the struggle that he went through to get where he is, and he's still have to be frightened in certain areas, in certain circles, and in traffic stops, and it could be Cornel West under a man's knee. That the thought, and you're like, no, that couldn't happen, but yes, it can. We watched it happen to Louis Gates at his own home.
Yep.
In that suburb that was close to work and blah blah blah, but. His own neighbor called the police on him because she didn't recognize that it was her neighbor. Oh, well,
Kelly, if that's a problem, why hasn't it been solved before now?
I think that that is the idea, the westernization of the globe. I mean, everybody wants to live in the suburbs. You go in the Philippines, they want to live in the suburbs. You go to Botswana, they want to live in the suburbs. Everybody wants to live in the suburbs, have a nice house and a big car. And we're not really too concerned with how you get it. You know, whether you sell drugs, you know, whatever you're doing, you know, they're selling kids and everything now. So people are just worried about how we get this money so that we can live this westernized idea of success. Which
okay,
is-
why is that a problem? And what's the solution?
It's a problem because it is not how we win this thing. It is diluting the Black community and taking what we consider the upwardly mobile of our race and moving them to an area where it benefits a predominantly white society, and then denying our own people our support at the same time. You know, that what is the logic in that at all? You know,
it's not as if we have a political economic system that values people or values priceless things like the natural world or priceless aspects of our cultural heritage, or to some extent, our time is priceless. It's not as if we live in a culture that values those things.
No, Western culture is not.
And it's not, I don't blame it on culture itself, and I don't blame it on people or people's natural tendencies. We have allowed ourselves to live in a system that where capital, to me, capitalism is where capital calls the shots, especially in the workplace, but also, you know, capital, you have enough capital, you can buy the best we have the best politicians money can buy, and you can buy policy. If you have enough money, you can buy democracy. If you have enough money, you can buy yourself a war. If you have enough money, you can buy yourself the right to pollute. If you have enough money, you can do anything that matters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's what we need to overcome and change.
Yeah. Oh, Jeffrey Epstein had bukus of money. That doesn't mean he wasn't morally bankrupt as hell. You know, it just the most vile of human beings have ascended to power at this point in time. And
if you talk about people having too much money, then the average American say, oh, you can't take their money. That's communism. And that's a system that's proven to be a failure. You can't do that. You can't take people's money. money. You have to let them enjoy their success, because that's the, you know, people giving people the right to acquire wealth. That's the engine of growth.
Well, see, wealth, you know, because wealth is not tied to intelligence, that's fine. I'm perfectly happy with everybody being as wealthy as they can, because that doesn't mean they're as smart as they can be. And a fool and their money are easily parted. You know, it's fine. I'm perfectly fine.
The
person who is always out there to try to get a little money, you know, like I said, Nicolas Cage, who is now almost bankrupt, bought a set of freaking white cobras. Like, let that be a true testament to what having money will get you, a set of white cobras.
We're speaking today on
whatever. The white cobras, like,
that's what I'm going to spend my first million.
USA, USA, somewhere where in India there is a little man. USA, thank you, Mr. Cage. Because that is how commerce works.
Right.
We're waiting. I mean, and we're commerce. Look at Etsy. Look at all of these little service-based businesses. People are creating a whole industry around servicing people who got more money than sense.
We're speaking today on Truth to Power with
babysitter, you can get a valet, you can get everything you want. You don't have to drive, you don't even have to read anymore.
Yeah.
We're speaking today on Truth to Power with Kelly McGuffey from
Kelly's saying, don't get me started.
Springfield, Tennessee.
Don't get me started on that.
Yeah, right. And I want to bring in a new member of the conversation here. We got another programmer on joining us on the line. That's K.A. Owens, host of On the Edge. Welcome to the show, K.A. Good to have you here, man.
Hey, ladies and gents. So happy to hear your conversation. Brilliant, very insightful and very timely. I'm just so happy that you all have decided to discuss our brother, Cornel West. You know, when we, one of my other organizations brought Cornel West to Louisville back in 2006 for our Unity Dinner, that's the Kentucky Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. That was our most successful Unity Dinner ever.
Wow.
And for years after that, I would be, you know, I would be at the Chase Bank making a deposit, and the teller would say, hey, that Cornel West was great.
Oh, yeah.
So,
phenomenal guy.
So I'm so happy that selected Race Matters. The Cornel West reader is good too for folks who, you know, want to get a book. I would say go to the library. Well, of course, you can't go to the library because the libraries are shut. But but I think you can like order on the web and then pick up the book at the door.
Yeah.
So reading is good. So. One of the chapters in Race Matters, the crisis in Black leadership, and it just seems to me in the time that we're in, you know, with the COVID crisis, the millions of people being out of work, and the police issues that we're all going through, it's time is either compressed or expanded. I can't tell, but it seems like every day is like a week and every week is like a month, and you never know what's going to happen. And people deal with that in different ways, but what I've noticed with all of these young people out in the streets every day all across the country, there are new leaders emerging as we speak. That's what I've noticed. And it's right here in Louisville. You go downtown to 6th and Jefferson, political education going on, marching, these caravans, 200-car caravans going around. That takes organization. That takes leadership. People are just stepping up to the mark. People I don't know, people that are really not necessarily part of the bourgeoisie that he talks about in the crisis of Black leadership. These people are emerging. They're talented. They're sharp. They're forming new organizations, again, as we speak. And it's the pressure. And so these kids being out here in the street and a little bit older and older folks, too. Oh, I marched last night, and the Bishop Lyons and Reverend Awkward were marching with the young folks. So So older folks are showing up. So,
K.A., I want to say that, you know, the civil rights movement was led by young people. We think of them as older folks, but if you watch documentaries about Freedom Summer, man, those are some young kids. It's very similar to what we see today, right?
They weren't invested like adults are invested. They aren't fearful like adults are fearful. You know, they have a whole different, fresh, untainted view of what they believe their future should look like. And at this point in time, if you're coming out for the first time to speak out, I think this is, if there was ever a time to get on a side of history and be a part of something and participate, it's now. You know, if the speaker forever hold your peace is where we're at right now. And I think that what he's saying is very true, and especially in Louisville. Taylor, she was your first responder. How is she dead? How is she dead? And how do you reconcile the balk at trying to arrest the officers that have done it?
And precisely you got three officers that were involved. One has been fired. None have been charged. None have been jailed.
No. And how do you tell a community that the police are here to protect and serve you, but they kill people every once in a while? And when they do, you know, our bad.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah, and you know, this talk of you know, youth and this sort of spontaneous, autonomous leadership, I think is really profound. You know, K.A., you said something along the lines of like people you don't know. I know for me, and I've been involved in, you know, activism in Louisville, you know, a fraction of the amount of time that K.A. has. But, you know, even in my low amount of experience, when I walk in a room and it's somebody I don't know, I'm like, oh my God, thank God. There are more people, you know, and you know, this
remember
idea,
when there were three of you,
right? Yes. And you know, so if I could just quote from the book one more time here, you know, he says, how can Black youth respect Black leaders when their plight and predicament is so flagrantly ignored by the mainstream, a mainstream that Black leaders speak to and influence? With few exceptions, and he lists a few, Black leadership tends to downplay the Black youth realities at the expense of Black professional advancement. Mm. Again, this priority is an issue of class and gender in Black America, and it is now coming back to haunt Black leaders. And I think that that's something that we're seeing here in this moment, especially. I'm seeing, you know, I thought it was the funniest thing the other day. They're saying that Black Lives Matter protesters target the first Black attorney general, I think it was in LA, and they were saying, well, this doesn't make any sense. And activists themselves were like, well, hang on, like, yes, this is a Black woman, but like,
guys, rein it in.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what they were saying. They were saying, Rain Man, come on. But yeah, these activists were saying, like, well, she has yet to charge any police.
Yeah,
who have...
same thing with Kentucky's Black Attorney General.
Mm. Right. That, you know,
Minnesota's, I mean, well, you know, Cornell tap dances all on neoliberalism.
Yeah.
All up in that, you know, but at the end of the day, racism is bipartisan. This is not a Democrat or Republican deal. This is a European American establishment that has got to be turned loose of. It's not Democrats or Republicans.
And I think that, you know, what he's, and I think that's really, I'm glad you say that, because you said it's a white, you know, sort of Anglo whatever, establishment. Right? The character of the establishment is what we're talking about. And I think what he's saying and what I'm hearing from you all, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, you can't just operate within this system and expect the system to change if you are still operating within it and giving it legitimacy.
Exactly.
You know, you have to tear it apart and rebuild and build something new and better, because if you simply infiltrate it, then it will turn you around. You won't turn it around, I think, is
exactly.
The fear.
You assimilate to be part of that culture instead of bringing your culture to that situation, which is why in 2020 we have Black women who are scared to wear their natural hair into professional environments for fear of not being taken seriously. Are you kidding me? It grows from her head naturally like that. That's the way it's supposed to look. How, you know, it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous the way that we force and contort ourselves to the point that we are two different people. We are a work person and an at the barbecue person. Mm. Why is that? Why can't this person exist in both spaces? Because I can only be one person. I can't manage two itineraries. I'm too busy. I have to just be myself.
Yeah. The biggest shock growing up was always hearing my friends when they were at work. And I'd be like, wait, what? That's not you? And they're like, man, I'm at work. I gotta sound like this. I'm at work. I learned the concept of code switching by watching people. And I was like, you have to do that? That's horrible.
Right. Like, what? But right, you're like looking at a whole nother person like, you don't even talk like that, man. What's going on?
Yeah.
Shut up. I'm trying to get by here. I need a raise, Jake. Shut up.
Right.
You know, I am trying to impress the boss.
Sure.
I love golf, sir. Yes.
Because at the end of the day, you know, you said impress the boss. And at the end of the day, you know, we have to think of who answers to who, right? Like, who's the man behind the man behind the man, you know what I mean? Like, who are we answering to? And the answer, you know, is shocking that I would say this, is capital. You're answering to the logic of capital, which
preach, brother, preach.
Which, as we know, is a concept that this nation was founded on in the plight to be a racialized capitalist society.
Yeah,
and you can't just turn that around from within. I don't think, you know. So I'm. You know, this conversation of leadership has been really fascinating.
If you will, let me read a couple of things. One thing he says here is that, this is from reading from Race Matters, we too often say Wall Street is a good servant rather than a bad master of the common good. So when you're talking about conforming in the workplace, what you're conforming to is a hierarchy. You're conforming so that there can be a path upward, at least a raise. Even if you don't make it to the top of the company, you want to be a little bit better off next year. And that means conforming. That means following the money, literally following what money wants you to do.
Yes.
So that's one thing. We need to look, when we look at all this conformity, we need to look at money. What are we conforming to? And I wanted to read something about, Cornell has a lot to say about empire. And I love that because I like to talk about empire. He says, the imperial meltdown is at the center of our catastrophic times. Our ecological catastrophe is real. The Anthropocene, meaning the age of man, the age of our, we're living in the age where man is in. So the Anthropocene ethic engulfs us. Human practices, especially big business and big military operations, now so deeply influence Earth's atmosphere that extinctions loom large. The potential for nuclear catastrophe remains urgent as U.S.-Russia relations escalate and other nuclear powers like North Korea, China, Pakistan, and India are expanding and restless. And he says, we deny that drone strikes are killing innocent people abroad. Then we overlook killing lists on Terror Tuesday at the White House when the president and his staff decide to execute people without any legal procedure, including innocent U.S. citizens.
Wow.
So at some point, I'm going to find another passage where he says, you know, Barack Obama is the friendly face of empire. Trump is the disgusting face of empire, but they're both faces of empire, you know?
Well, they're both faces of America is what he was saying.
Right.
Obama is America and so is Trump.
Which doesn't always mean a good thing.
Well, both of us came at us with two different perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you think that Obama is this, you know, this guy here and Trump is this guy here, but both of them are increasing the deficit. Both of them are spent exorbitant amounts on defense when it could have been spent on education. Like I said, Obama played right on into the game. He just kept the ball right on rolling. You know, instead of working on race matters, instead of working towards better health care, instead of, and going after the insurance companies instead of saying, and the hospitals, and saying, instead of making us the people buy insurance and then letting those industries readjust to fit, you know. So now my insulin costs $800 a month where it was $100.
That is criminal. It's criminal. It has nothing to do with the good of the people. It has everything to do with the profits on Wall Street.
And if you're going to set one bar here, you've got to put a balance on the other side of the street. Because what has happened is we've been held to task to buy insurance while these unregulated industries have just, look at the guy that bought the AIDS drug. Why is there not a law that says you can't mark a pill up 1,000 times?
Exactly.
Holy crap. He was about to start killing people. Literally killing people for money. It was insane.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left, and this book came out in 1993. Just a brief reflection on how things have evolved over those years.
Well, Clinton gave us a Democratic Party that collected more from Wall Street than the Republicans, and the same has been true. The same was true of Obama. Same was true of Hillary Clinton, collecting more from Wall Street than their Republican alternatives. Mm. So, and then part of Wall Street is the prison industrial complex. Prison industrial complex imprisons a whole lot of black people because, as I think Chris Hedges says, a person is not worth anything to a corporation when he's on the streets, but he's worth $30,000, $50,000 a year behind bars. Mm. That is when you sell people for money, that's slavery.
Yes.
And on that note, I'm afraid we are all out of time, my friends. I wish
on that cheerful note.
Wish we could go on for another hour. This has been a great conversation here on Truth to Power. Thank you, Kelly McGuffey, for joining us from Springfield, Tennessee. It's been great getting to know you.
It was awesome. Thanks for having me, guys. Anytime. Just give me a holler.
All right. And thanks.
On Saturday nights, we go out on Fridays.
Oh, terrific. And thanks so much to K.A. Owens for joining us, Jake Bush from DSA Louisville, and Hart Hagen from The Climate Report. Heard every day here at 7 p.m. I'm Justin Mogg. It's been a pleasure, and we'll be back in your ears again in 1 week's time.